It is Thursday, January 31st, 2013, and this is Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellums.
I'm Christina Thomas. Support for KUAF comes from To Enjoy Magazine, a local publication featuring the arts, culture, and entertainment. The January-February edition showcases comprehensive health and wellness. Subscriptions and more information are available by calling 464-8900 or on the web, joymag.com.
Ahead on Ozark, some dangerous cows and a local dog goes to the Big Apple. The cows are part of a Springdale couple's new board game they hope will soon be available in stores across the country.
The dog is headed to the biggest dog show in the world. We'll meet Spike, an Ozark-born and bred Russell Terrier headed to the Westminster Show in Manhattan.
First, as a coalition of gun control advocates pushes for a new federal assault weapons ban, Arkansas's U.S. Senators Mark Pryor and John Bozeman say they cannot support California Senator Dianne Feinstein's bill. Senator Pryor says the objective should be to lessen gun violence, not, as he puts it, violate people's constitutional rights.
I think everyone agrees that the goal here is to keep guns out of the hands of criminals and the mentally ill and young people, while at the same time protecting our Second Amendment rights of law-abiding citizens. The question is, how do we do this and how do we lessen the gun violence? So I will, continue to look at proposals here, but I'll also continue to listen to Arkansas and listen to law enforcement.
Senator Pryor says the bill is cumbersome, confusing, and includes about 100 pages that list specific weapons. And he says there are no details on why certain guns are banned and others accepted. Senator Bozeman says people have the right to arm themselves.
What I'd like for us to do is have a real dialogue as to the cause of the violence. I really feel like that the gun is more the tool. It's not the cause of the action. I don't think disarming law-abiding people is the answer that it really would make that much difference.
Both Arkansas senators say there should be more of a focus on putting additional police on the street and improving mental health services.
A new bill in the Arkansas Senate would lay the groundwork for all but ending the state tax on groceries. In his State of the State address at the beginning of the legislative session, Governor Mike Beebe expressed his desire to abolish much of the tax on food items. Earlier this week, Republican State Senator Jason Rapert of Conway introduced a bill that copies the governor's suggested wording for such a bill. Rapert says that the tax could be ended if a number of triggers are met.
Those triggers include the settlement regarding the desegregation case in Pulaski County. We stop having to put nearly $70 million a year as a result of that settlement into that school district. That would free up general funds in the state budget to help with this. In addition, also some of the bond indebtedness, if that were to be paid off, the governor has that trigger in there as well. I promised when I first began running for political office that this is something I wanted to see done away with in the state of Arkansas. And this is an opportunity where you have a chance to work in a bipartisan fashion on an issue that's important to both sides of the aisle.
All but 0.8% of the grocery tax could be abolished if the triggers identified in the bill results in $35 million of additional revenue over a six-month period. The 8-cent tax would remain as written into the state constitution to help fund the Arkansas Game and Fish Commission. Rapert says that he feels morally obliged to lead the charge in the state Senate to end the grocery tax.
Arkansas has historically been a very poor state, and I've never been able to make sense of the fact that being a poor state in the first place, why have we continued to tax people's grocery items? Inflation has affected the cost of food all over the country and here as well, and with the cost of energy up, people now paying anywhere from $3.25 to $3.50 for gasoline many times. I would love to bring this relief, which touches every single person here in the state of Arkansas that buys groceries.
The bill has been passed on to the Senate Committee on Revenue and Taxation, but hasn't been scheduled for further debate.
The bill known as the Church Protection Act of 2013, which would let churches in Arkansas allow licensed concealed firearms in their congregations, headed to the House Judiciary Committee today. The bill cleared the state Senate earlier this week, and the bill's lead sponsor, Brian King, a Republican from Green Forest, says he's confident the bill will clear the House.
Yeah, I feel pretty good. I mean, you never know about a bill till it's all the way through, but the way we're going about it, we're allowing each church to make their own decision. We're not forcing any decision. That's been one of the biggest misconceptions about this bill is when they see the title on maybe the news story or something that says guns in church, they just think we're forcing it on them, and it's certainly not true. We're just allowing them to make their own decisions We're not forcing anything on anybody. So I feel pretty good about it, but you never know.
Senator King says while recent shootings in Newtown, Connecticut, and Aurora, Colorado have captured the public's attention, the issue of safety from gun violence isn't a new issue.
This issue just hasn't been coming up here recently about security. I mean, we know that churches have been targets for some evil people that want to cause harm and go in and shoot people. We also know that churches, they deal with youth, and you can have some issues there. You can also know that churches are being broke into. If you do a search of that here in Arkansas, you'll see a lot of cases. I think even down here in Little Rock, it was some months back that even a church service was robbed during the service. We also know that pastors, they may counsel couples in marital distress or situations like that that could be contentious.
Senator King has been pushing the issue of guns in churches for a few years. He introduced a similar bill in 2011 when he was in the state house.
The Ozark Literacy Council yesterday announced that through its volunteers and staff, it taught 300 students last year, an increase of 69% over 2011. Wendy Poole is the executive director of the organization. She says that much of the increase in students is a result of increased marketing, but she says that the growth is not without its hurdles.
We don't have a staff. This is done with 2 full-time employees and 5 part-time employees and 60 to 65 volunteers. So we need more resources to grow our student population, and actually we need more resources because our school is limited in size as well. So we're limited in resources as in hiring more ESL teachers and a bigger space.
Poole says that about 98% of students that the Ozark Literacy Council serves are English as second language learners. Roughly 1/3 of those students are Latino, another 1/3 is Asian, and the other 1/3 is a mixture that includes students of European or Middle Eastern descent. Poole says that while the Ozark Literacy Council was founded with both ESL and basic literacy students in mind, the demographic of students served has skewed in line with shifts in the overall population.
In the Washington County Census, there are 15% of our population is speaking a different language than English at their home. So that is growing immensely. And actually in the state, Arkansas is ranked number 4 in immigrant population growth. So yes, those numbers are changing. Washington County just happens to have a lot larger immigrant population than the rest of the counties.
Poole says that she only envisions a greater need for the Ozark Literacy Council's services in the future, which is why they apply for numerous grants to help the organization grow. She cited a recent statistic by the Winthrop Rockefeller Foundation that found that for every dollar spent on services to immigrant households in the state, immigrants generate $7 in economic activity.
Partly cloudy tonight. Lows will be in the mid-teens in northwest Arkansas, dropping to around 14 for much of northwest Arkansas. Mostly clear tonight in the Arkansas River Valley, lows in the lower 20s. Tomorrow, sunny with highs in the lower to upper 40s throughout the region. And for Friday night, partly cloudy, lows will be around 30. This is Ozarks at Large. At this hour, the Energize NWA Summit is taking place in Rogers. Nearly 200 participants are at the John Q. Hammond Center discussing possible initiatives to make Northwest Arkansas healthier. The summit is the work of the Endeavor Foundation, and already this morning has included an address from Arkansas Surgeon General Dr. Joe Thompson and a speech from Tracy Fox, the president of Food, Nutrition, and Policy Consultants, and a policy consultant with the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation. Earlier this week, just a couple of days before the summit was to begin, I visited Jill Kaplan, the Vice President of Strategy and Communication with Endeavor Foundation, at her office in Springdale to find out more about today's summit and what is expected to happen after the summit concludes. About 180 business people, educators, city officials, and others signed up for the summit.
We're really focused on bringing together all of the key decision makers that can help make our community healthier. So everyone from mayors and superintendents to city planners, nonprofit professionals, civic leaders, corporate citizens that are working on making a difference here in Northwest Arkansas.
Now, I know over the past
several months, past few years, Endeavor has backed healthy initiatives, including the Razorback Greenway, the walking trail that's going to connect most, if not of all, of Northwest Arkansas. What other sorts of strategies will be discussed Thursday?
We see the summit really as the first step in a larger range strategy for the region. And so the real work will begin the next day when everyone's had a chance to sleep on the great aha moments that they've felt throughout the day and really act on those. But, you know, Endeavor Foundation really sees this as the community's initiative. And so we really see, again, the summit as the first step in an opportunity to move forward with partnerships. We're going to be leveraging resources and really getting those into the hands of the folks that can make a difference.
She says there are already some fundamental pieces in place in Northwest Arkansas to encourage healthier lifestyles. The Razorback Greenway Trail system that's expected to be completed by the end of the year. The thriving farmers markets throughout the region offering local food and local school programs devoted to bicycle use and safety. And while she says the concepts discussed or introduced today are important, the true success will depend on what happens next.
It's not just about being in the room at the summit, but really beyond this, there will be an awareness campaign. We'll have a website. We will be creating an interactive map where folks can actually see how to physically get active here. What trails can they use to walk and bike their kids to school? And, you know, really focus on engaging everyone in the community, because like you said, it's not just about those 180 people. It really is about our community embracing the idea that as the seventh most unhealthy state and the eighth most obese, we really need to do something about this.
The Endeavor Foundation's efforts were further aided this week when, on Monday, the national organization Convergence Partnership announced the Endeavor Foundation was one of 13 recipients nationwide to be awarded a grant to help fund healthy changes.
What the Convergence Partnership focuses on is equity and policy changes that support systemic change. So not just what can we change today, but how can we make changes today that will be helpful in changing behavior and access for tomorrow.
Following today's summit in Rogers, there will be a website to be launched soon devoted to possible programs. And later this year, a formal request for proposals will allow groups to make pitches for funding in connection with the idea of creating healthier opportunities in the region. Interest appears to be high. Today's summit actually had a waiting list of participants. Jill Kaplan says the next step is to actually make a difference.
As a community foundation, we're always focused on how we can move the needle and measure that we've moved the needle. That's one of the things that the Convergence Partnership is really going to help Endeavor Foundation with in terms of measuring our success, because Convergence has funded other community foundations who are doing precisely this work.
Jill Kaplan is Vice President, Strategy and Communication for the Endeavor Foundation. The foundation helped put together today's Energize NWA Summit, along with sponsors Walmart, Sam's Club, Arvest, and Procter & Gamble. It took place at the John Q. Hammond Center in Rogers. I talked with Jill Kaplan in her office in Springdale on Tuesday.
Next week, the University of Arkansas will take some time to salute graduate students. Graduate Education Week began last year on campus. Yesterday, we invited two of the organizers to the studio. Don Farver is a PhD student in civil engineering. Dr. Todd Shields is the dean of the Graduate School in International Studies at the U of A. He began by telling us about the idea behind Graduate Education Week.
Well, we just wanted to really raise attention to all the wonderful things that graduate students are contributing to the university. The university reached the Carnegie Very High Research Classification last year, and a lot of that is because of the research and the teaching that the graduate students do. And we just thought it was time that the university set aside a week to recognize all the wonderful grad students that we have on campus and all the work that they do.
It's kind of because I think still for many of us, when we think of a college campus, you think of those still traditional, even though it's far smaller population than it used to be, the traditional undergraduate.
Right.
And you forget how many people are continuing an education on campus far beyond that bachelor's degree.
Yeah, and increasingly, you know, with the tougher economy, more and more people are attending graduate school. Sometimes that's a tough economic decision, particularly when their jobs are few out there. But many people are finding that the master's degree or a PhD really helps them set them apart from the competition.
Well, that leads into a question that I had. Used to, people would say, you know, you have to have a college degree to do anything. But now then it kind of seems like you need a master's degree.
In some fields, that's definitely a requirement. Increasingly in teaching and accounting, those two come to mind really quick. You can certainly get jobs without the master's degree, but it's increasingly common to have that master's degree when you go out there. And we're seeing that trend across the country, that increasingly people are being encouraged to go ahead and get a master's degree. And that is personally my recommendation. In a tight job market, that is the smart thing to do.
Never hurts.
It doesn't. Mm-hmm. Mm-mm.
Don, you have your undergraduate and master's from Ohio State University, working on your PhD in civil engineering at the university.
Yes.
How did you make the decision to go ahead and go for the PhD?
After I graduated, and kind of it's sort of the same story of why I went and got my master's, I was doing work in an environmental engineering field, and a lot of people were telling me that to increase your efficacy in the job market, it makes a lot of sense to do that. They're looking for master's degrees. So I got my master's degree and really enjoyed my time and wanted to continue doing work in the area I was doing. And at the time, there were not any positions locally that were doing that work. And actually, I met a professor from the University of Arkansas at a professional conference, attended his presentation and spoke with him, and ended up coming to the University of Arkansas on a distinguished doctoral fellowship. So that was my track from Ohio State to Fayetteville.
So what's going to happen next week?
Next week is, I'm really excited about it. This is the first year I've been really involved as the graduate assistant for the Graduate School and Career Development Center. And we're going to have a lot of different activities going on, and a lot of them are for graduate students. And so different departments are doing their own mini programs to honor graduate students, like breakfasts and lunches and just saying, you know, thank you for your work. And the Graduate School in International Education is also doing programs for graduate students to help them, whether it's about applying for a federal grant, if they're master's students looking to go on to a PhD, about applying for graduate school. We also have a reception for our distinguished doctoral fellows, and so we have a lot of events just centered around them, helping them find jobs, helping them apply for grants and do their jobs. And then the really exciting part, the culmination, is our poster competition and creative design competition that's happening on Friday, where we have about 120 students from all across campus, everything from apparel studies, theatrical design, to space and planetary science, and engineering, and agriculture, all kinds of different things. And we're bringing them together in one space. We have a new location. We're going to be at Mullins Library, which we're really excited about. And from 1 to 3, it's completely open to the public. So we're going to have our judging going on, and then anyone can come and see all the really cool research going on at the University of Arkansas that our graduate students are doing. So a lot of different events that we hope people come out for and kind of support our students.
Is there such thing as a typical graduate student?
Not really. I mean, they come from all walks of life, and increasingly we have people returning who've been in the workforce for a long time and they want a career change, or they've hit a ceiling that they want to go past, and then the extra graduate training really helps that. So we're seeing a very different crowd, demographic of graduate students than even when I went to graduate school. We're also seeing a much more diverse and international demographic in grad school now.
How does the university as a whole benefit from graduate education and the graduate school?
Well, we spend a lot of time talking about this, to be honest, and I'll let Dawn contribute to this since she's actually participating in that. But, you know, graduate students, they're basically mini faculty, mini students, mini staff members. They do everything that every group on campus does. I mean, really, they're faculty because they teach classes. They're researchers because they're working in labs. They're writing grants with professors. They're students because they're taking classes. And they're staff because they work in labs and they work in athletics and they work in the library. And so really, they are a great investment, and they do an amazing job. And in fact, modern land-grant institutions, in all honesty, cannot function without graduate students.
I know when I was doing my undergrad that some of my teachers were graduate students for the first couple of years. Yeah,
We teach about 25% of the credit hours on campus. Mm-hmm. And so in a lot of cases, that's lab courses, but also as instructors of record. And so, you know, even for the undergraduates, if they're understanding a little bit more about what we do, I think that's excellent too, because it's easier for them to just think of us being a face. But I think that I've always really enjoyed the courses that have been taught by graduate students. Our graduate student instructors do really well on their teaching evaluations. They're really excited about what they're teaching. They're excited to be teaching at all in some cases. And so I think they bring a lot to the classroom that way, as, you know, as new, but they do their work.
That's a really good important point. And I think a lot of times people, when they first enter a class, they might think, oh, I've got a graduate student, right? In many cases, that graduate student is on the cutting edge of research, perhaps more so than some of their professors. That's one reason that graduate students are often such great teachers. The second reason is that graduate students have to be great teachers or they'll never get a job. So they have an incredible amount of pressure to be and to continue to be better teachers. And then the third, and the reality is, they're just closer to the undergrads in age. So they get it when they're talking about iPhones and apps and stuff like that.
Or even what movies you saw most recently.
Exactly.
It hasn't been that long since you were a graduate student.
But that's right.
Can you tell now in your position, has anything changed for different schools and different locations? But do you think there have been any significant changes since you were a graduate student and being a graduate student now?
I would say that it was easier when I was in graduate school. This is the late 1980s and early 90s, and, you know, there weren't as many people going to graduate school. I don't think that it was nearly as competitive as it is now. There are a lot of disciplines. Certainly when I was in graduate school, if you had published something in a peer-reviewed journal, that was really exciting. Now in many fields, it's almost just expected. You have to have, and maybe not even one, but maybe a couple. You have to have in some fields some patents, in some fields some grant money. And so it is a much more competitive environment now. But then again, we're also doing things that weren't available to me when I was a graduate student, like these education weeks. We put on seminars and presentations on how to write grants and how to make sure your data, you handle them with integrity, how to get published, how to interview for jobs, how to think about your academic career, how to think about your non-academic career, which, by the way, a lot of people in PhDs now are just saying, I'm not going academics, I'm going into the real world, quote unquote. And so lots of those types of things didn't exist when I was a graduate student, but graduate schools across the country have said, you know, we need to do as much as we can to help our graduates succeed, because in all honesty, it's tougher than it ever was.
Don, do you know what is next for you?
Oh, gosh. Not 100%. I'm planning on graduating this year and have been having that same conversation of what I want to do next. I think I may go into industry, and as I've told people, be an engineer for a little while, since I've been training to do that for a long time, and have been looking at teaching opportunities at some smaller schools where they do value having that real-world experience for sure, to help their students. So I think academia is in my future at some point. I'm just not sure when. So,
And if people want to know more about Graduate Education Week?
They can go to our website, which is grad.uark.edu, and click on events.
And that final portion is open to the public with the poster competition.
From 1 to 3 on Friday, February 8th, we want everyone to come out to Mullins Library and see what our graduate student research is like.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you both.
Thanks.
Dr. Todd Shields is the Dean of the Graduate School in International Studies at the University of Arkansas. Don Farver is a PhD student in civil engineering. They came to our studio yesterday to discuss Graduate Education Week at the University of Arkansas. The observation begins Monday.
On this week's Generic Blues Show, I have new music from Anna Bergendahl and Mark Robinson. Also, some Candy Cane, Sue Foley, Julian Foth, George Harmonica Smith, Marquise Knox, Chuck Lavelle, and more. Join the fun. That's Friday night at 9 o'clock, the Generic Blues Show on KUAF. We'll see you then.
It is Thursday, the final day of January 2013. I'm Kyle Kellums.
I'm Christina Thomas.
With us, Becca Martin-Brown. She's features editor at Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
So yesterday I reminded you that The Rock is going to be in Little Rock with a wrestling show on the 12th of February.
You did indeed.
Please buy me Valentine's tickets, somebody, really. But here's a couple of other notes to plan ahead for. On February 16th, Civil War Secrets of Osage Springs. It's a program of stories, intrigue, danger, and injustice with Doug Kidd and Paul Dolly that happens from 10 to noon or 1:30 to 4 on February 16th at the Rogers Historical Museum. They are taking reservations for this now. It is $5.
Great.
Another Valentine's Day gift.
Absolutely. 621-1154. Or on March 9th, you can be one of the first to see American Chronicles, The Art of Norman Rockwell.
At Crystal Bridges.
Opens that day and is open through May 27th. Tickets are available now at crystalbridges.org/exhibition/Rockwell. If you just can't wait, plan ahead.
Don't you think, because Norman Rockwell has such a place for so many people in this sort of Americana and American art, don't you think this is just going to be people
huge
all the time?
And I think, wonderfully enough, it will be people who might not have gone to Crystal Bridges before.
Right.
They're iconic images.
Oh, gosh, sure. Yeah, the Saturday Evening Post covers. The Norman Rockwell Museum is somewhere in the Northeast, isn't it? Like Connecticut or Massachusetts.
Wouldn't that be fun?
Yeah, and I think a lot of this, if not all of this, is kind of on loan from the Norman Rockwell Museum. Should be great.
So this exhibit, you have to pay to get into.
Unless you're a member, I think.
Unless you're
don't
a member.
Quote me on that.
Okay.
But I just put it on the radio, so that's I'm kind of quoting myself. Check the Crystal Bridges webpage.
Check the webpage. Get your tickets, even if there is no charge for it. And again, none of us is sure, and we're sorry. But even if there isn't, you're still going to have ticketed reservations.
Exactly. Exactly.
Thank you, Becca. Becca Martin Brown is features editor with Northwest Arkansas Newspapers. Carpet award season is upon us as film and television celebrities strut their stuff. But it's also the green carpet season. In less than 2 weeks, more than 3,000 dogs will pose and prance for the judges and cameras at the famous Westminster Kennel Club Dog Show. And this year, Spike and Ozarks born and bred Russell Terrier will face the paparazzi. Ozarks at Large's Jacqueline Froelich takes us to meet him.
See?
Spike, a Russell Terrier, yips for a treat this morning. Clearly, he's not a big talker. Spike looks more like a farm dog than a top show dog, which he is. He's shedding and scruffy and on a diet, poor guy. But soon enough, he'll be bathed, brushed, and buff. Spike is competing along with 3,200 other dogs in the 137th Westminster Kennel Club America's Dog Show at Madison Square Garden in New York City.
He may just walk in and go, yeah, so we're here again, you know.
It's because Spike, who is 10 years old, knows the show dog circuit like the back of his paw, having competed for many years. His handler, Nodie Williams, breeds Russell Terriers for show, as well as Irish sport or dressage horses, at Frayed Knot Farm outside of West Fork.
These dogs have been bred for intelligence, companionability, and hardiness, as well as conforming to a breed standard, but they really don't thrive in a cell block environment any more than people do. So we have large grassy pens, they go out, they're handled every day. There's a person that lives there 24/7 and takes care of them in and out, plays with them, talks to all the babies, they're handled. They're never just confined to a stimulation barren environment.
Spike's roots are mid-19th century English terrier, bred initially to hunt foxes. Crossbreeding of working terriers with other dogs eventually produced the Russell Terrier. Their slightly larger cousin, the traditional English Jack Russell Terrier, was made famous on the American landscape by Moose, the dog star of the television sitcom Frasier. Nodie Williams, spokesperson for the Northwest Arkansas Kennel Club, has bred Russell Terrier since 1981. She says they're great companion dogs, charming, and easy to train for show. She sells puppies but doesn't consider herself a commercial breeder.
You will never find a conscientious show dog breeder, breed club representative who will sell a dog to a wholesaler, to a dog that is not going directly to its owner that they have not personally interviewed. These dogs, and who will not always take their dogs back. I will always take my dogs back.
All sorts of show dog breeders will converge on Westminster, which will be telecast. There we can view the sporting breed, which includes your happy retrievers, compulsive pointers, and affectionate setters. The hound breed showcases funny bassets, elegant Afghans, lithe greyhounds. The working breed includes giant Great Danes, cold-loving Siberian Huskies, hyper boxers, and massive St. Bernards. Then you'll see the toys, your darling Papillons, Palms, Poodles, and Pugs, Dalmatians, Bulldogs, Skipper Keys, and Bostons, among the non-sporting breed. The herding clan contains sheepdogs, collies, the queen corgis, and brilliant Australian shepherds. Finally, we have the terriers, the Cairn, Fox, Skye, Scottish, West Highland, Norwich, and the newest to this year's competition, the Russell Terrier. That's our Spike.
To be entered in Westminster this year, because they've added more space and they won't be totally judged at Madison Square Garden, they have opened it to dogs that were not finished champions yet. But you did have to have a major win, which means you have to defeat enough dogs in your breed to make it worth 3, 4, or 5 points. You still had to have, to enter the best of breeds, you had to be a finished champion. Since the Russells were only accepted for championship status since June of last June, it was, you had 6 months basically to get, well, actually five, because you had to have your entries in before December. So you had that long to finish your championship and get your dog in a competitive situation.
Westminster's dog show breeds compete by sex and class, including puppies, dog bred for exhibition, American bred, open bred, and immigrant dogs. There's also a winner's class, best of breed, and best of winners. The top spot is best of show. Judges look for top physical structure, condition, gait, and temperament, giving bad marks for shyness or viciousness. The entry fee is just $25, but the number of entries are limited.
And it's a two-day show, and you have to take your equipment, you have to have a crate. Minimum requirements are someplace to put the dog on the bench, because the dogs have to be available for public viewing from the entire day of the show. It's one of the few shows in the United States that last over one day. They do four of the groups on Monday. They do the remaining three on Tuesday, plus Best in Show. So it's a big production number. And, you know, New York's expensive. So like, getting there is kind of just the ante for the game.
Spike, along with a couple of his close relatives, will be on call the second day at 9:30 a.m. for the judges, and on show for public viewing until 6 p.m.
There's 15 Russell Terriers entered, with 12 of them being finished champions. Among those, Spike, his daughter, and his son are three of the entered champions, and then his granddaughter will be entered in the classes that have not made their championship yet.
And Spike is an old exhibition pro. He excels in lure coursing, that's chasing things on a string along a structured course, earth dog, tunneling to bark at rats, and obedience, which he's sort of good at. And get this, he's also top United Kennel Club winner in Great Britain, his ancestral stomping grounds. So he has an excellent shot, even though he's getting a little gray around the muzzle.
He's just a good old dog. He deserves to go. It's like, I think he heard me telling a friend that I thought, oh, I just can't go. This is just too much. And he looked at me and said, where are we not going? And I said, Westminster. He said, what? We're not going? He said, we are too. You better take me. Okay, so he won the argument.
Live coverage of Westminster's 137th annual All-Breed Dog Show will air Monday, February 11th at 8 p.m. on CNBC and Tuesday, February 12th on USA Network. And we'll be rooting for Spike, the Ozarks Terrier. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Jacqueline Froelich.
If you'd like, you can visit this story on our webpage, ozarksatlarge.com, to see a photo montage of Spike and Noti posing for the paparazzi. You can find Spike on Facebook at Frayed Not dogs. And to check out the competition, you can go to westminsterkennelclub.org. Many thanks to Alice and architect David McKee for letting us tape the story at their studio. This is Ozarks at Large. Ahead on this edition of Ozarks, Jody Beznoska from Walton Arts Center gets us caught up on what's going to go on at that venue in the next few weeks, plus the cows of the game Monster Moose. It's based, well, it was created in Springdale, might go worldwide soon. More about that in just a moment. You ever acted, Christina?
Have I ever acted?
Yes.
No.
Well, here's your chance. Rogers Little Theater will host auditions for the Broadway hit Goodbye, Charlie. The auditions are February 11th and 12th. At 7 p.m. both nights at the Victory Theater on South 2nd Street in downtown Rogers. If you'd like more information, 903-6547.
We kind of have an animal-heavy show with Spike the dog, and then you just talked about cows.
Yes.
So, anyways. Humane Society of the Ouachitas hosts regular pet adoption events Saturdays in Fort Smith. Check out devoted dogs, playful puppies, and curious cats. All pets are healthy, spayed or neutered, and have been vaccinated. For adoption rates or to view pets online, visit hsomina.org.
Did you see the New York Times report this week about the new study that finds out how many mammals and birds, cats?
Oh, and I think it was on Morning Edition.
It may have been. I first saw it in the Times. It's billions. Mm-hmm. It's about twice as much as previous reports. A national group of scientists pooled all the local reports and found out it's like 14.
That's a lot of critters. Yeah.
Yes. Mostly mammals like shrews. Mm-hmm. And what was really interesting is it's not many what are considered varmints, like rats or something mm-hmm. like that. It's mostly rabbits, shrews, and birds.
Mm-hmm. Cute animals.
Yes.
Aww.
The Senate's got one plan to overhaul the country's immigration laws. The president's got another. There may be room for compromise.
For the first time in many years, Republicans and Democrats seem ready to tackle this problem together.
But is that true in the House? I'm Neil Conan. The coming fight over immigration policy, next Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
Talk of the Nation just ahead at 1 o'clock on KUAF.
This is Ozarks at Large. Last week, Nathaniel DeMille came to the Anthony and Susan Hoy News Studio to play a game.
So you start off with your five cards.
Okay.
And your goal is to basically get three of the same color. And that's how you wrangle a moose. So like, for instance—
You dealt me three yellows.
Yes, exactly. So if you wanted to, on your turn, you could actually play those out in whatever order you want.
The game is called Monster Moose, and players try to round up a herd of otherworldly cows. Cows that are ghosts, zombies, cyborgs, or dragons. Actually, Nathaniel, who teaches mathematics at the University of Arkansas, really came to the studio to talk about the game rather than just play it. The game was invented by Nathaniel and his wife, Dominique, and it's designed for parents and young children to play together. The inspiration came, he says, from necessity. The DeMilles enjoy playing strategy board games like the popular Settlers of Catan, a game in which players create settlements using randomly assigned resources like ore, grain, and lumber. Nathaniel says they notice a problem with some of those games, however. There's a very high learning curve.
If you're going from, like, Monopoly to games that have, like, real choice, and the choice, like, instead of, like, a choice between a good choice and a bad choice, you have a choice between two good choices. You know, people who aren't often gamers, they get paralyzed, you know, that whole paralysis of choice issue. And so they don't necessarily approach the games, like, with as much enthusiasm as we do.
New players are not likely to realize how important early moves are in the game, or...
Or the other downside is that you're the guy teaching them to play it, and you have to sit there and spend five or six games intentionally losing or sandbagging. And it's like, you know, why should, when you teach somebody a game, you not have fun? And why, when they're learning a game, should they not have fun? Learning the game should be just as fun as playing the game, or easy enough that learning it takes, like, you know, a few seconds or a few minutes, and then you're instantly into playing it.
And that's if the experienced game players are trying to teach fellow adults. It can be much harder to keep a child's interest. And the DeMilles know they want to be able to play games of strategy soon with their own son, Octavian. They wanted to create a game that had basic enough concepts to not bore a younger player, but enough strategy to keep parents entertained. Monster Moves, their game, they say, fits that bill. And it does so on a kitchen table, not on a screen.
We have all these wonderful electronic games. We have all this wonderful electronic media to do. Everyone is just coming out of the woodwork making, you know, iPad apps and things for kids and all that. And there's a lot of, like, games coming out for kids. But what we noticed is that there are some, but not a lot, of games that are specifically designed for gamers who have kids to kind of play those games with their kids.
Nathaniel and Dominique have devised the prototype for their game. It includes hand-drawn, color-coded cards, an elaborate playing board, and a set of rules easily understood after just a few minutes. Each player takes on the role of a cosmic cowboy trying to rustle up the supernatural bovine, either an entire herd of one kind or a big enough variety of all the different kinds of imaginary cows to score enough points to win. Players can choose their own strategy for populating their ranch. And the DeMilles want to make Monster Moves available for all families. To do that, they've turned to that 21st century financing scheme, Kickstarter.
And that's where Monster Moves comes in. So if you're like us and want to pass your hobby on to your children, then pledge to Monster Moves today and help us bring Monster Moves from our table to yours.
That's a video from the DeMilles Kickstarter page. Kickstarter allows entrepreneurs, artists, musicians, and others to seek financial support from anybody interested. For the Monster Moves project, people can pledge support from $1 to $1,000 toward the mass production of the game. In return, depending on the level of support, you can receive a personalized edition of the game or special recognition in the credits. Pledges only have to be honored if the entire goal of $15,200 can be raised by February 15th. Potential investors can see the breakdown of expected costs, preliminary artwork, and more at the page. There's even a video showing how the game is played. Nathaniel DeMille says there have been plenty of test runs of his game with adults and kids.
And we really tried to capture the feel of those adult-child shared movies like Shrek and things like that, where there may be jokes the kid doesn't get, but the dad does.
Creating a game that can have just enough complexity to keep parents truly engaged, yet basic enough not to intimidate a 7-year-old, is a delicate equilibrium. It raises the question, when does a game maker know when the right balance has been struck?
Never. but really what we do is it's an iterative process. We start and we make the game. And when I design the game, I design it. And there's really two big major steps that go on here before production. That's design and development. And when I design the game, it's basically me kind of staring at a wall, thinking through playing the game and playing through the games in my head and running through these things and writing stuff down.
Nathaniel says one of the most important characteristics he and Dominique built into Monster Moves is that the game is played to win. It's not a game you play not to lose. Unlike Monopoly, Risk, or some other games, every player remains a contestant until the very end.
And when I look at those, I look and I say, okay, what is fun to the most people? Because what I tend to find is like, okay, if a game lasts 2 hours, but you have the ability to be eliminated in the first 20 minutes, you're not going to have any fun. You know, or if you get into games of everyone's been there. They've been in that game of Monopoly where it is almost inevitable who is going to win. So we just look at all those elements and we try to mitigate what we think is not fun. And we try to maximize what we think is what makes a game a game.
Just when a copy of Monster Moves is available to the general public depends on the success of the Kickstarter page. As of this morning, a little more than 2 weeks until the February 15th fundraising deadline, the game already had nearly $6,000 in pledges, better than a third of the needed total. If you'd like to learn more, you can go to our webpage and find a link to the Monster Moves Kickstarter page. This is Ozarks at Large. This is Ozarks at Large for the 31st day of January 2013. I'm Kyle Callum.
I'm Christina Thomas.
With us is Jody Beznoska. She is Vice President of Communications at Walton Arts Center.
Hi.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi.
January coming to a close. What does that mean for you folks?
Well, that means Memphis next week. Yay.
That's right.
Finally. Wonderful, wonderful show. Actually, if anyone's going to be at the Razorback basketball game on the 5th, we will have a singer there. So check that out. That's the first day.
Okay.
Tuesday, opening night. Yep. We'll be there doing the national anthem, which is fun.
Wait, someone from the cast from Memphis.
Mm-hmm.
What are you going
to
then?
This is what we do to bring you the word about these shows. They're going to come, they're going to sing, and then we're going to zip them right back to the theater. Yeah. The show starts at 7.
The show starts at 7.
What time's the game?
I think it's like 6:30, something like that.
Okay.
So it's going to be pretty fast.
Bud Walton and the Walton Arts Center are relatively close.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
And we park at the door, you know, and we like race down the hill.
Special
you're
going to have
privileges. Like this black sort of limo thing.
Yeah, like a big SUV that takes us down the thing.
Police escort.
No, we've done this a couple times, actually, where we will we'll bring talent to, you know, to the games, and it's a lot of fun. It's a different way to see these performers, because usually you see them all dolled up and dressed up on the stage, and you forget that they're really just really good singers, and so they're going to get a great national anthem. I think that's the Florida game on Tuesday.
I'm very concerned about this turnaround.
Well, and we're going on the opening night.
Yes, we are.
So,
you'll be fine.
Okay.
And it's also usually, I mean, they do this a lot. The touring companies do this a lot.
Okay.
And, you know, she may not appear until later in the show. That happens sometimes, too.
Absolutely. Okay.
So don't worry. It'll
all
be
right.
Okay.
Okay.
It'll be really cool. So Memphis starts on the 5th, which is Tuesday, and it runs through the 12th, I think, which is Sunday, or maybe it's the 11th.
10th.
10th, you're right.
6 days, 8 show
you're right.
Schedule.
You guys got this down.
I've been reading it on air for a while.
Really, really high quality show, original Broadway musical. It was, I believe it won the Tony in 2010. I think I have my dates right with that now. Yeah. And everybody at Walton Arts Center who saw this show 3 or 4 years ago cannot wait for it to finally play here. It's going to be great.
Now, the big difference between a couple of years ago, there was the musical that was kind of based on the Million Dollar Quartet, also based in Memphis, at the Sun Record Studio.
Yep.
That used music you were familiar
correct.
With. Correct. Of the 50s, the dawn of rock and roll.
Yep.
This is all original.
This is original. It has that flavor, it has that feel, but it's been written to be brand new and original just for, you know, just for this show. It's great. Oh, I can't wait. Can't wait for Memphis. Everybody needs to come to Memphis. the 5th through the 10th. And then I believe in the middle, after that, we will have T2 starting up their third show of the season, Sons of the Prophet. I think that starts on the 14th of February, Valentine's Day.
I believe so. And just a note that Saturday afternoon at 3, you can meet the playwright.
That's right.
Pulitzer Prize-nominated playwright with some of the members of the cast.
Yeah, that's a big deal.
Fayetteville Public Library.
This Saturday.
Yes.
And, I mean, his show was literally just on Broadway
yes.
like a couple years ago. So that's a pretty cool thing. So that was Saturday, you said.
Right.
And then we will bring the Potted Potter guys. Can't wait.
We're going to hear from them on tomorrow's edition of
Ozarks
at Large. Yes.
Oh, that's going to be fantastic. So the quick summary of this is all 7 Harry Potter books condensed into a 70-minute show put on by 2 guys who are from England, and they don't use a lot of like bells and whistles. They use the audience, they use themselves. There's an element of improv to the show. It's going to be really funny. If you're a Harry Potter person, you must try to find a way to see this. And this is one that we really do think it is all ages. So I think they say that this really is for all ages from 0 to Dumbledore, who is very old indeed. That's the
right over your head.
Right over my head.
That's the reference.
Yeah.
But, so anyone can come see it and have a good time. We just put the single tickets to the Grace Kelly Quintet on sale last Friday. I was reading about her. She's amazing.
She's 20 years old, has her own band, 8 CDs.
Yeah.
Robert Ginsberg talked to her last night. We're going to hear from her next week. And he said, you know, she seems very well-rounded, very, very smart, and knows her stuff.
The words he used with me was she's the real deal.
Yeah.
Yeah. So she's a saxophonist herself, and she has a band with her, but it sounds like it's going to be just pretty amazing. So that's on the 16th. So that Potted Potter and Grace Kelly will be running on the same night together.
And Grace Kelly has 2 shows.
Yes, a 7 o'clock and a 9.
Right.
Either 9 or 9:30. And her shows are in Star Theater. Mm-hmm. We'll have The Little Prince for little kids, for little princes and princesses, on the 19th of February. And then we will have Hair on the 22nd through the 23rd. And then it's March. And there's all kinds of things going on in March. We have Dance Brazil. We have Carpenter Colvin show, Mary Chapin Carpenter, Sean Colvin. For a minute there, I forgot their first names. We have Sir James Galway, the man with the golden flute. He comes on March 14th. And Garrison Keillor on the 28th. We just learned, actually, that Garrison Keillor's show is going to have musicians with him. He's basically decided to change up the show, and it's less of a speaking conversational and more of him and some of his favorite musicians coming along with him. So those tickets are going fast, NPR people. So make sure you get them quickly. And then let's look ahead real quick and make sure people don't forget the Popovich Comedy Pet Theater on the first week of April. This guy has been here before.
I thought so, mm-hmm. Yeah.
He has something like 30 or 40 animals on stage with him, and they do crazy tricks. And I believe they're rescues. I think that's the story. And if it's not, it should be, because it's going to be a great story.
Big cats, like tigers and stuff?
No, or I just think like, it's like dogs.
Dogs, yeah. And
domestic cats. Okay. That sort of thing.
I'm not going to be in Walton Arts Center when there's a loose tiger. I'm just telling you. No.
I mean,
Kate, we've never had a tiger.
No. Don't ever.
Okay.
What? Why not?
It's dangerous. Have you seen how big they are?
Yes,
they're wild animals. You don't want them in the same building with you. No, you don't. You don't.
Well, speaking of things you do want in the same building, yes. You do want Anything Goes, which is the touring version of the Broadway show that is put on by Roundabout Theater Company. That's coming in April 9th through the 14th. Absolutely glorious Broadway musical. If you're the kind of person who wants to remember a simpler time, this is the musical for you. It is so great. It's beautiful. The tap dancing numbers will literally, your jaw goes through the floor. You just can't believe they can do it, and they can do it that well. It's fantastic. So that's April, and I think we'll stop there because it's kind of hard to think.
Because then you're getting toward Artisphere.
Yeah.
Which will have
all kinds of good things.
Discussions continue about next year's?
Mm-hmm. Yep. Right. We will probably be talking about next year, maybe end of this month, 1st of January.
Okay.
First of March?
Yeah, sorry, 1st of March.
Okay.
Thank you, Jody.
Thank you, guys.
Oh, one other thing I want to point out. Oh. The Arkansas-Florida game on that Tuesday night is a 6 o'clock tip-off. It's an early tip.
There, see?
So we're okay.
We're okay. Fine.
Everyone's
we'll be fine.
Okay.
All right. let's also remember to tell people you can get your tickets at wildsandartscenter.org or 443-5600 or come down and visit us at the box office.
All right.
Jody Besnoska is Vice President for Communications at Walton Arts Center.
And almost time to end today's program, but first, your chance to win some movie tickets, movie passes to any Malco movie theater in the area. We're going to give away three pair.
Okay.
You know what? No. I feel like one of those late night infomercials. But wait, there's more. We're going to give away three sets of four. So maybe you can take you and three friends or three members of your family.
Or go twice.
Or go four times.
Four times.
Yes. Hopefully you'll take someone with you. Okay, so three winners. Each will win four tickets, passes to a Malco movie theater in the area. Tonight is the last night for 30 Rock.
Okay. Tina Fey.
One of my favorite shows. It's about a woman who, for most of the run, was a single woman working in television. Mary Tyler Moore, decades earlier.
Single woman working in television.
Right. And what I want to know is what city, now 30 Rock takes place in New York City, in what city did Mary Tyler Moore's character Mary Richards work?
I feel like I should know that.
She worked at the television station WJM, worked for WJM News. What city was that? OzarksAtLarge@gmail.com. All right.
This is KUAF 91.3 FM, Fayetteville, Rogers, Fort Smith, and Hartwell.
Where is Hartwell?
It is just southeast of Hinesville on 412.
It's on 412?
I mean, on the map, it looked like it was on 412.
Is there a sign?
I don't know. I can't recall ever seeing one.
I can't either. Are you sure it's right on 412?
Well, the little diamond on the map.
Okay. All right. Well, and the thing is, we have a very extensive map here, and often there are those communities that have kind of disappeared.
Right.
But Hartwell.
Hartwell.
If anyone knows about Hartwell, let us know.
Okay.
We found out about, what was the town in Missouri?
What was it? It was blue something.
Yeah. But we have great listeners.
Something blue.
Yes, we have great listeners who tell us all about
Ginger
it.
Blue.
Ginger Blue, right. Ozarks at Large, a production of KUAF. I'm Kyle Kellums.
I'm Christina Thomas.
Thanks for listening.
Happy Thursday.